Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on number one News and Talk Station.
Welcome to The Money Show. It's brought to you by Old Mutual. Do great things. We're going to be talking about the currency trading story that is doing the rounds at the moment. Gary McNamara at Sundown Private Wealth. I'm looking for him to explain what made Murray and Roberts go off the charts this week. We'll do the best bits of The Money Show. Plus, we'll play the Brutal Biz Quiz. And standing by to chat to us is the owner of the Stratton Watch Company. His name is Kyle Schutt. Named in last year as one of the top 200 South Africans to watch, watch literally, because he is a watchmaker par excellence, and he's selling lots of these watches, but that's not why we're talking to him. I want to know how he used crowdfunding to fund his business. Lots of you contact me and say, I need funding for my great idea. We'll learn from Kyle Schutt in a couple of minutes' time.
The Money Show,
your number one news and talk station.
Well, some very interesting developments in the currency trading scandal that broke this week. It would seem the reason Citigroup and Absa are not facing fines alongside 12 other local and international banks is because they may have cooperated with regulators. The investigation started in 2015, and in addition to about a dozen local global banks, Investec and Standard Bank and, of course, Absa are implicated. Absa, though, not being prosecuted, leading to that speculation. The allegation is that groups of traders used the Reuters trading platform and Bloomberg chat rooms to conspire to rig the rand, and it goes back as far as 2007. The Competition Commission today naming a small handful of currency traders, it says, are implicated in the scandal. There may be more, but they named a couple of them. Absa suspended a guy called Duncan Howes in 2015. Investec head trader Clint Fenton is also named, and numerous other people within Standard Bank as well. Investec issued a statement this afternoon saying that the bank has received a complaint referred by the Competition Commission. We note that the case against Investec Limited is confined to the conduct of a single trader who is employed by the bank. The bank seeks further information and will cooperate, etc., etc. Not just a single employee, the head trader. But nevertheless, that is the statement from Investec. What normally happens in currency trading is that traders determine the prices of what are called bid offer spreads. And that's supposed to happen independently. And by discussing in any way what that spread should be is collusion. They manage to help each other out to get prices to levels they wanted by coordinating trading times. They also created fictitious bids and offers, and that made it look like there was a whole lot more demand for the currency than there actually was. And it would seem as if they coined it. Ismail Momoniat is the Deputy Director General at National Treasury. Your National Treasury, Ismail Momoniat, yesterday issued a very emotive statement on this particular issue, calling for hellfire and brimstone on the banking sector if anybody is found guilty.
Yes, Bruce, I don't know if it's emotive. I mean, as you know, we've been quite involved with strengthening the regulatory system that applies to the financial sector, to banks in particular. Obviously, these were the very type of abuses why we've implemented a Twin Peak system, where we are going to be establishing a market conduct regulator to supervise, to ensure that financial institutions don't embark on, you know, such abusive practices.
But it's taken an awfully long time to get this Twin Peaks model in place. And I look at it in the context of 2008-2009, when it emerged that one of the reasons for the global financial crisis was that executives, management boards didn't understand the complex financial products that were making them massive profits. And even if they suspected that anything was wrong, they tended to turn a blind eye. Could we have a similar situation in South Africa, where a small group of traders have taken advantage of a loophole, they work in a way and in a market that very few people understand, and their bosses weren't paying close enough attention to what they were doing?
Yes, look, we've certainly taken too long to implement the new system. I think the point is that after the 2008 global financial crisis, that kind of approach by any board is no longer an excuse. Because since then, you've had Basel III to firstly make sure that trading activities are covered. And in some countries, the laws seek to separate the trading activities from the deposit-taking activities of a bank. And secondly, there are much tougher market conduct or treat customers fairly practices now in countries like the UK, US, and so on. So it's no longer an excuse for a board to say they don't know, look the other way, particularly if something's very profitable. They've got to make sure that they not only have systems to check against this, but that they have preventive systems, that they've also got systems where they don't just rely on reports from traders, but they are checking on these traders. And really, the issue when these problems come up is how quickly will your system bring up such issues to the to management, and two, how quickly does management act when it becomes aware of these practices?
It suggests a breakdown of those checks and balances in Investec, APSA, and in Standard Bank. Is that a fair comment?
Well, look, it's hard to say because, you know, just before this interview, again, we only know as much as you in terms of what was made public by the Competition Commission. I've just a few minutes ago been able to download the actual charge sheet that's been circulated. And whilst it provides a few names of traders who possibly entered into these abusive practices, there's very little information. So, and the other thing is that the period covers 2007 to 2013. Now, you know, for example, if the, most of the activities were closer to 2007, certainly that was an era of light touch regulation. The closer you get to 2013, obviously you started having much more intrusive and intensive regulation in most in many parts of the world. And certainly after, you know, Basel III, you would have expected that banks would have certainly put in place much tougher internal preventive mechanisms. Now, I'm just saying. So it's going to depend on what period, because it will also then demonstrate to what extent our regulatory initiatives are actually working or not working.
I mean, today we saw the Mineral Resources Minister, Mosebenzi Zwane, saying that that statement he issued in the name of Cabinet, which was a blatant lie, it wasn't a Cabinet statement, that there should be an inquiry into the banks. This vindicates him, does it?
Look, I don't want to go into those issues again. I think the key point is we need to get the details and understand who's guilty of what. Remember, there's 14 foreign banks. There's three domestic banks. A lot of these rand trades, over 60, I think more than 60%, is conducted outside of South Africa. And then the issue is whether these were just individual rogue traders. Or was it more than that? Was it collusion from management?
If there is collusion from management, what should the sanction be?
Well, then I think the full sanction should apply, whatever it is. I mean, I don't think we're attempting to, you know, the law is the law and it needs to be applied. Now, whether it's someone who's corrupt in the private sector or in the public sector, one needs to be even-handed and apply the full might of the law.
The Ismail Momonia, Deputy Director General at the National Treasury. Thanks for joining us this evening on The Money Show.
The Money Show. The Friday File.
Let's go to something distinctly calmer and a little less divisive and a little bit less concerning and maybe inspirational, because lots of you email me to say, please, I need money for my business. I need you to connect me to somebody rich who can fund my business. And it's not something I can do. It's just not feasible. But here is information on how you can do it yourself. Kyle Schutt, who is the owner and founder of Stratton Watch Company, on the line to us from Switzerland. I was wondering where you were making your watches, Kyle. You raised lots of money using crowdfunding because you've got massive mad passions of classic car racing and watches, and you turned that second passion into a business using other people's money. How did you do it?
Thanks, firstly, Bruce, for having me on the show. Appreciate it. Well, I wanted to start the business in 2012, and unfortunately, the risk far outweighed the reward, where I needed about 200,000 rand to start the business, because I had a 500-piece minimum order quantity that I had to place with my manufacturer in order to start the business. Unfortunately, I, of course, didn't have that kind of money lying around. I needed to find another option of funding the business. So at that stage, I didn't know about crowdfunding. So in 2014, I picked up the idea again because I read about crowdfunding and decided to do a bit of investigation into it, and found it to be a viable option to fund the business. So what I researched is which platform could I put the idea on, and I chose Kickstarter.com, which is probably the world's largest crowdfunding platform that has raised in the last 7 years more than $1 billion in contributions towards various projects. So what they require you to do is to create a prototype of your product. And in my case, it was watches. So my first watch was called the Vintage Driver Krona, inspired by my personal classic car from 1977, an Alfa GT, Alfa Romeo. And I wanted 200,000 Rand in order to start the business, and I needed to reach that goal within 35 days in order to start the business. So to my surprise, and I was completely bowled over, when I launched the project on Kickstarter, I reached that 200,000 goal within the first hour of going live.
What was it?
35 days.
You had 2.5 million rand. But what captivated the imagination of the Kickstarter community that said this is worth supporting, as opposed to the other 10,000 ideas that might be there?
Sure, I think what was key to my success is I marketed the idea solely, you know, mostly towards the automotive branch of people, you know, the racing side. And I did that 3 months prior to launching the project on crowdfunding. What many people make the mistake of doing when they decide to crowdfund a project is they think, okay, well, I'll just come up with an idea and put it on the website, and boom, you know, I'll be funded with a few million rand. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. People need to, you know, put in the time beforehand. People need to know about you before you actually launch, so that when you launch, you know, it builds momentum, and then that momentum just carries through. And I just think myself in marketing the idea and my personal touch to it, my story, I think, is what also captivated people. Is the watch was inspired by my own personal car. The dial resembles the rev counter of the car. And I couldn't have imagined the roller coaster ride I was in for when I clicked that launch button.
That was for the first watch. You then did a second watch, and you ran a second round. Was that, I mean, then you kind of knew the rules. Was it easier? Was it quicker?
Yeah.
Was it bigger?
It was easier because I know, you know, the process. You know, the easy part, I think, is getting to the point where you funded. The hard work comes afterwards when you actually need to manufacture and deliver the product, because that is why people give you the money, so that they get something in return, which in my case is the watch. So my second watch launched, it was bigger. I raised just around 3 million rand for my second watch, which I delivered towards the end of last year. And I've currently, right now, as we speak, my third design is on Kickstarter. It's running until the 5th of March. It's called the Stratton Synchro, as well as my own range of accessories, which is a racing-inspired stripe bag, duffel bag, for you know, a weekend away or something like that. And currently it's raised just on 2.6 million rand with another 16 days to go. So who knows how big it will go. I'm just very grateful and blessed, and putting in the hard work and seeing that hard work being repaid.
What were you doing to make a living before you came up with this killer idea?
Well, I'm actually still currently fully employed. I have a full-time job.
Doing what?
I'm a business development manager for a relocation company.
Okay.
So, you know, Stratton Watch Co. is my sideline business, but I manage everything from A to Z, the daily running. So I think that's what also my customers appreciate, is they're dealing with the owner, designer of the watch. So if there is a question, or if anybody emails info@strattonwc.com, they will speak to me. They won't speak to a customer service agent or anybody like that. So I think it's that personal touch that people appreciate. And I build relationships with my customers, and I've seen many repeat loyal clients have come back from my first watch to the second watch and now the third watch.
Watch this space. Kyle Schutt, thank you for chatting to us this evening, the owner and the founder of the Stratton Watch Company. That's his sideline business. He's raised so far, rough calculation, 2.5 plus 3.5, that's 6. And he's into the next round, and he's sitting at about 3. He's raised about 9 million rand, 8 or 9 million rand, through crowdfunding in 3 different tranches to create a new business, a new watch business, plus accessories, driving gloves. I'm not sure that we're the home country of driving gloves, but he's got a global audience. He's got a global market now, and he's working hard to build this business, but getting crowdfunding to do it.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield.
Got a note from Investec people to say Clint Fenton, the man named by the Competition Commission today as being a suspect in the currency collusion case, is not the head trader at Investec, just a trader. I have asked them whether or not he's still at work or if he's been suspended, and I'm waiting for that particular answer. Gary McNamara from Sundown Private Wealth. More and more of these huge global deals being done in terms of food. Today, Kraft and Heinz got together a couple of years ago, so now they're Kraft Heinz. And now they want to buy Unilever, or it wants to buy Unilever. There's far too much of these big gorillas becoming even bigger.
Bruce, yes, absolutely. And I think it's a function still of these type of companies being massive cash generators. They do carry quite a lot of debt because of the strong cash flow. They can price their debt very attractively. We've seen recently the Anheuser-Busch SAB type. It's all on the same principles. These guys have got cash and they want to just get bigger and bigger, cut out the costs, get the critical scale. And I think while we've got the low interest rates and cheap funding, we're going to see more and more of this. I don't know where the competition eventually stops, but certainly we do see more and more of these mega deals. And I think it is because of the cheap funding that they can obtain.
Now, okay, so that's part of it. I just don't want the guys who make Dove soap necessarily to make my Cadbury's chocolate. You know, that's just me being fussy. Now, Murray and Roberts, the great market-moving mystery. Is there a connection at all to an announcement today that Coronation have sold all of its shares in the company? Yesterday, Murray and Roberts was up 33%. Today, another couple of percentage points?
Yeah, I don't know who the buyer is, but management did come to the market to say they didn't know either, and that was early this morning. But I would speculate that given the premium paid, we will see some changes or boardroom changes. Certainly somebody that's paying that type of price has got a plan, and I think it could involve some very strategic stake or, if not, control on the company. So I don't know who it is, but I say, as they say in the classics, watch the space, all will be revealed, and that should be fairly soon.
It must be very unsettling. I mean, you're sitting in the boardroom of Murray and Roberts and your share price has gone up 37% in 2 days and you're going, okay, who was it? And nobody says a word. Nobody knows. Somebody knows, but we just don't know. Iron ore price is rallying strongly, $90 a ton today. Brilliant for Kumba Iron Ore and everybody else who digs iron ore out the ground, but will it last?
That's the million-dollar question, Bruce. I think if you'd asked everybody a year ago when the iron ore price was sitting at $35 or $40 a ton, it looked friendless. And there was talks of oversupply, no demand, bearing in mind China's the massive consumer of iron ore in the globe. And there wasn't a friend in sight. And suddenly in the last 6 months, it has really rallied. And it probably fundamentally was one of the metals that probably had the least favorable outlook. And it's probably performed the best when you compare it against copper and the like. So it's certainly has done very well. Where to from here? I would suggest it's probably run its course in the short term. It's rallied up quite strongly, well above its cost of production. So I would look for it to pull back. But at this stage, there's certainly quite a lot of support for the metal.
Are investors in banks getting just a little bit nervous that perhaps the story around currency trading has got more legs than they might have thought when it broke on Wednesday?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, Bruce. The market hasn't really reacted as much to this announcement. Bearing in mind, if you rewind a week ago, we had the State of the Nation address, and almost Zuma predicted there was going to be some sort of attack is probably the wrong word, but they will be looking at the banking sector. There was quite a lot of reference to capitalist control, etc., etc. And then we've had this announcement, and it's almost, in my view, too prophetic, too controlled. But certainly, as you say, say the market hasn't overreacted to it. They were marginally down yesterday. Pretty much across the board, they were down about 1% today. But there was no difference between the banks that have been implicated in this report and the ones that haven't. For example, First Rand hasn't been talked about, whereas Standard Bank has. There hasn't been a massive difference in the share price movement. So I don't think the market is taking too much credence from the deal. And as the previous speaker or the previous commentator said, those markets are very difficult to manipulate. They are massive, and South Africa only controls internally probably 30 to 40% of the rand market in that. So, you know, we'll have to wait and see what type of detail they put out there. But certainly we'll have to watch the space on this one.
Gary McNamara with Sanlam Private Wealth.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, your number one news and talk station.
The Money Show, brought to you by Old Mutual. Do great things. Welcome to The Money Show. On the next Money Show, it's the People's Budget. I want your ideas on how the Finance Minister can raise new revenues, can focus on cutting spending. We'll also have an expert on hand to give you instant feedback on how good your idea is. And we'll submit the best ideas to Treasury ahead of the budget. Plus, Dr. Eve and our Make Money Mondays personal edition, talking money for a change.
The Money Show. Bruce is on Twitter. At Bruce Business.
Ranier Fenter on my Twitter feed says, is Brian Molefe becoming an MP a precursor to ousting Pravin Gordhan? I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, there's a lot of speculation that that is part of a longer-term game plan. And I was never a big believer in conspiracy theories until around about the 9th of December 2015. And now, in a world of extraordinary vested interests, it's very hard to know what to believe. The fact is, Brian Molefe, whose integrity was called into question at Eskom, he didn't stick around to fight that those allegations against him. He resigned from Eskom, is emerging without any real clarity as to that integrity as an MP, and will be sworn in as a member of parliament. Whatever is at play, I do not know. I don't know. But certainly, he's taking a big pay cut from his days at Eskom. To go and become a member of parliament, probably get paid a tenth as much. So, yeah, it's an interesting move, Ranier. I don't know the answer to that question. Time now for the best bits on The Money Show. And lots of you are downloading The Money Show podcast. You're listening to the podcast, and I thank you for doing it. Please keep sharing the podcast. We've had lots of really good stories this week and plenty of results. One of those results, the interview wasn't really about the results. Chris Griffith, Chief Executive of Anglo American Platinum, took us through company results on Tuesday. But before he did that, he told us the answer to the question that many people had been inquiring about in the last week or so since he appeared at the mining Indaba in a wheelchair. It was all about going one-on-one with a buffalo.
I'll tell you one thing about an interaction with a buffalo. There's only one winner and one loser, and I was not the winner.
So the buffalo got off lightly, did it?
It sounds light, and one day it'll be a great war story, but it was actually quite a serious incident, but I have been recuperating well over the last month or so.
Okay, so I mean, I'm assuming you were having a walk and stumbled across a buffalo. They're one of the big five most dangerous animals in the world. You must feel lucky that yes, you were in a wheelchair, but you are on the mend.
Yes, indeed, Bruce. So we were walking actually in a camp in Tanzania, and we startled a buffalo in the evening. My wife, myself, and a Maasai, and this buffalo. And I think that's the story of Africa. You don't have to be the fastest guy, but you must just not be the slowest guy. And in this case, the buffalo managed to butt me in the ribs when I was on the ground, butted me again in the back. I had a fractured knee, damaged other knee. So quite a lot of damage, but I'm mending well. I've had my knees had surgery, and I'm on the mend.
And then he told us about the results. We also look at the traditional soppiness of Valentine's Day in a different way, and we turn it into a money story. Valentine's Day demand for chocolate failing to boost the cocoa price. Either we become less romantic or cocoa supply around the world has been boosted. It's hit multi-year lows, concerns about a glut in West Africa, and confusion over exports from the Ivory Coast. So we went to Mr. Chocolate, Paul Raffaele, the co-founder of Nomu Brands, to explain to us why the cocoa price wasn't responding to the amorous advances of lovers all over the world.
If you look at what's happening broadly, there's a lot more cocoa going around. Prices are going to come down for a while. But a lot of this is also being driven out of West African markets where There hasn't been any prolonged civil strife of any particular note, although it's a fairly consistent thing to experience. It's not been as bad recently, so production has come up. But it still hasn't really fully recovered. Your average West African farmer is still broadly disincentivized from farming cocoa as a crop. It doesn't make a lot of financial sense. But regardless of this, in the other markets, where South America, for example, there still isn't enough cocoa being produced out of those markets to make much of a difference. The bulk of our cocoa is still coming from a place where there is now more being produced overall, but less being consumed in some of the developing markets. You do have another question to answer, really, which is that what happens when those developing markets really wake up in a year or two's time, and when markets like the Far East, for example, suddenly really do discover a sweet tooth. This is not something that has fully been explored yet. We're already beginning to see far more interest coming out of the Asian markets. Things like luxury hot chocolates are very interesting over there, simply because sugary treats in the form of sort of mass market consumable sugary chocolate brands are still widely sort of misunderstood or not considered in the same sense that a Western consumer might use them. So what happens when those palates suddenly wake up to it in about 2 or 3 years' time? And what happens if there were to be another break in supply coming out of West Africa? I think then we'd be facing a very serious issue. But for what it's worth right now, to answer your question, things in cocoa, there's plenty to go around. And conveniently for us, plenty in the very premium and quality section as well.
Paul Raffaele at Nomu Brands talking cocoa. Mike Turk, Chief Executive of Cardi's and SA Greetings, spoke to us about the trends that he is seeing around your spending on Valentine's Day.
Well, the sales over the weekend were good, and then obviously a lot of last minute. If I looked at the profile, sex profile of the customers this afternoon, predominantly young males, full of guilt and lining up and saying, I'm going to drop the ball unless I do something quickly. Money wasn't the issue, and standing around in queues wasn't the issue. So very few females left in the queues, but a lot of males.
I would think you could almost price your Valentine's goodies a bit like airlines do, reasonable prices up until the day before. And then if you want to fly on the day, you're going to pay double what you paid yesterday. You could do that with Valentine's merchandise, Mike.
You know, we're such a price-sensitive industry, and reputations can live and die by a price. So, no, we don't play around with the pricing at all. And we certainly have a bit of inventory left over, so if anybody's left it far too late for today, they can pop past quickly in the morning and apologize afterwards and still do the right thing.
Or stock up for next year.
Today. Or stock up.
Yeah, or stock up. Volume-wise, is it too early to tell how you've done?
Look, we know we're tracking better than last year. Well, obviously, we've got 50 stores, and we know what happens on a daily basis. And the week leading up to Valentine is always the key week, and also depending on when Valentine Day actually falls. So Tuesday, believe it or not, is not a bad one. You've got a whole weekend.
Yeah.
You've then got a bit of a Monday hangover, and then tomorrow, guess what? You can still go and make amends. So you've almost got a four-day build-up. When it's on a Friday, it's not great. We're definitely tracking better than last year on Valentine.
Midweek Valentine's are best. Mike Turk, he is the Chief Executive of Cardi's. Then Make Money Monday's personal edition. For the first time, an economist walking into studio. That economist, Dr. Iraj Abedian. He used to make carpets from scratch as part of his household chores as a child growing up in Iran. We spoke to him about that very first job.
First money I earned in my first year of university. I realized that if I wanted to be able to study and buy my textbooks and additional material that I needed, I had to take a job, and I do it. From 4 to 9, I took my first job, and I was very proud of getting my first paycheck.
What was that first job?
I was an administrative assistant into a English college that was doing extramural English tutoring, teaching, and I was doing the admin work.
Where did you learn English? I mean, Iran was a very international country at the time. I mean, it was the part of the social set, wasn't it? I mean, it was a very open society.
Absolutely, it was open, and English was part of high school, but at very, very elementary level. So I learned my elementary English, literally, by elementary, I mean elementary, and then supplemented it with extramural studies. But I really began to learn English when I came to Cape Town in 1980, and registered for honors. Then I realized I knew nothing.
But what an extraordinary leap, though, to come to South Africa. Of course, Iran was in turmoil by then.
Yeah, that's right.
And that brought you to South Africa, and you then had to learn a whole new language in which to study in a field that you were learning.
That's right. It was an extraordinary, when I look back, a parallel challenge of one learning English and then doing economics honors. And economics itself as a discipline in South Africa is taught very differently from what we were taught in Iran those days. Our courses were highly mathematical and quantitative. Mm-hmm. South Africa was largely descriptive and very little maths and the stats. So that meant English was far more important for being able to read volumes and understand and then write exams, as opposed to doing maths, which was much simpler.
WN traffic in a moment, but not just yet. Tiraj Abedian, the economist, sharing with us some insights, deep insights. And if you missed that, it really is. If you're going to go and listen to one Money Show podcast this week, go and listen to Tiraj Abedian's upbringing and the values and what he learnt about money growing up in rural Iran. Then came all the way to Cape Town and became one of the country's most respected economists.
The Money Show.
The Biz Quiz.
Time for the Brutal Biz Quiz this Friday night. Where will you find David Jones? Where is David Jones most at home? That's a tricky question. David Jones, where is David Jones's home? That's the first question in tonight's Brutal Biz Quiz. Give us a call. 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702.
The Money Show.
The Biz Quiz.
Let's play the Brutal Biz Quiz on a Friday night, Zanele. Where is David Jones most comfortable at home?
Australia.
Australia is absolutely right. Along with Country Road and Trenery, home of those three brands. I spoke to Ian Moyer, the chief executive of Woolworths. What would you buy from the Truworths-owned UK retailer Office in the UK? I learned this yesterday.
I don't know.
You don't know?
No.
Well, then I'm afraid I'm going to have to let you go, Zanelli. But thank you for coming. Thank you for coming to our party. Thank you for playing. Let's try Bernard. What would you buy at Office in the UK, Bernard?
Clothing.
No, you wouldn't, I'm afraid. I need to be more specific than that. It's something you would wear. There's more than one of them. So what would you buy at Office? What is the focus? I immediately thought clothing as well, work clothing and uniformy sort of clothing. But Mark, it's not, is it?
No. It's shoes.
Shoes, absolutely. That it looks like a posh version of Techie Town. Don't tell Michael Mark I said it. Which airline was ordered this week to pay Comair more than R1 billion after years of anti-competitive behavior?
I'm going to guess SAA.
You are absolutely right. Good guess, Mark. We spoke to Guy Leach about the story this week. It goes back to incentives that were offered to travel agents to give favor to SAA. There was a patent for a very important device that was filed on the 14th of February, 1875. It was Valentine's Day, and Alexander Graham Bell got to the patent office first and patented what?
Telephone?
The telephone, absolutely right. He filed his patent application for the phone on the same day that Elisha Gray filed an application for a similar device. Gray withdrew his application. Bell was granted the patent. There was a huge amount of controversy as to who should be credited with the invention. We say the telephone was invented by Alexander Graham Bell. What was originally called a gramophone award?
Originally called a gramophone award.
No, nowadays, the gramophone awards still exist, but we call them something different. Something cooler, something more hip.
Grammy.
You're sounding unsure, Mark.
No, the Grammy.
It is a Grammy, absolutely right. You are the Wiz of the Biz Quiz. Mark, congratulations to you. Unfortunately, there's no sort of big money prize to give up, but take it as a dry run if you are still inclined to go into the brain of 702 or the brain of Cape Talk. The Grammy Award, the Recording Academy recognizes outstanding achievement. And I told you about a 54-year-old executive named Rob Stringer, who's the biggest winner out of the Grammys this year. And it is funny, I mean, with most music around the world being digitally downloaded, we still call the awards after the gramophone, the original way in which music was played to the masses.